You're listening to Red Setter, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
Hi, and welcome to this week's Red Center. I'm Mike Seymour. Hi, Jason. How are you?
Hey, Mike. I'm very well. Thank you.
And this week, we're going to have the pleasure of having Stu from the orphanage join us again. We were going to discuss some stuff, Jason, to do with some announcements, which are apparently now irrelevant.
Yeah.
But, Stu, are you there?
I am, yes. Hi, guys.
Hi. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So there was a nominal concept in our head of discussing the November 13 announcement, which, seemed to be a good idea at the time up until last night.
Great idea.
when Red declared that everything that they'd pretty much done was... Now, what were the words? It was...
Insignificant. Yeah.
Exactly. This November 13 announcements are insignificant compared to the power of the Force, compared to December 3 announcements, which were just... the announcements were announced yesterday.
I have two questions. Firstly, wasn't the whole point of the 13th announcement that obsolescence was now obsolete? So why did they have to make it obsolete so quickly?
This is only, the obsolescence only applies to cameras. It doesn't apply to announcements.
Okay.
Yeah, insignificance is not obsolete, but... Okay.
And my second question is it true, Stu, that the Blue Project is in fact a Spanish leak of the Red Company?
Yeah, I think, Jim's fed up with how slow, the Red Project has been developing, and he started something new called Blue.
Do you actually know what Blue is?
I surely don't. I don't speak Google translated Spanish very well, but it seems like a website and maybe some hats so far, but
there's a loyalty card.
And a loyalty card, but it is important to remember that there was a time not long ago when that's all Red was, so who knows.
That's exactly
I think
right.
You once said, was it you that said that Red was basically a plastic model and a promise at one stage, and it looks like Blue is currently a coffee loyalty card and a hat and a business card, but who's to say they won't do something interesting? We're not making this up, by the way. You might think that this is some kind of comic routine you've tuned into, but in fact, there is actually a website. Does anyone know what the URL is? That is the Blue Project.
It's a very complicated URL, actually.
Then we'll put it in the show notes. But it's basically
bluecam.es, I think.
A cryptic indication of a European EEC-type Red project. Called Blue.
Yep.
We know a little more about it. If you guys know about it, or you happen to be sitting in Spain and know the guys that are running it, please contact us. We'd love to validate or otherwise its plans moving forward. So let's
1080p, 2K, HDR cinema. That's all it says. And you can get a little loyalty card, which shows your loyalty to Blue and helps, I believe, you pay for the loyalty card on PayPal, which helps pay for the development of Blue Camera.
Yeah. One can only wonder. Hey, so Michael Scott, who we had on last week, who actually went to the Red thing in Los Angeles at Fox Studios, I'm quoting here, said, "I think Red is the first company to have proven themselves legitimate, only to then turn themselves into a vaporware company." Stu, is it Red doing itself harm by actually immediately rehyping, having so quickly redone its hype from IBC? I mean, is it actually gone a step too far in the open development?
I think so, given that the only currency they have is the hype and enthusiasm and the loyalty of the fans. I think the general current that I'm sensing in response to this re-announcement is a little bit of weariness. It was we all had fun staying up late and watching the announcements and renders stream in, and yet there's always this little trickle of understanding that these are just ideas and that they will change and that this is far in the future that we're talking about, and so you want to get excited about the idea, and then you kind of want to get on with your life, and Jim is preventing us from doing either of those two things right now.
I mean, certainly from my point of view, I don't think it's a cold, calculated move. I just don't think that Jim or the Red Company is like this sort of Machiavellian marketing company. I think they just honestly, stuff comes up, they get enthusiastic about it.
I think I would be exactly the same. I think if I knew new stuff, I'd be going, oh, just busting to
get it. But having said that, I think if they'd framed this in terms of, wait, there's more.
Yeah.
On December 3, there's one more thing. That would have been empathetic to the community. At the moment, it's, oh, by the way, it's all changing, which I understand the kind of gag of it's, you know, just... But having said that, to a certain extent, to have any realistic aim of hitting targets at some point, you know, especially with anything that's going to be engineered in more quantity than the Red One, you're going to have to settle and get some stuff, you know, prototyped and up and going.
Well, we should maybe...
And of course, you know, at maybe one's least generous, one might criticize Red for having more enthusiasm for announcing things than for delivering them. And I don't mean to cast aspersions, but you can just, you know, point to the things like 4K projectors and Red Ray and all of the various enthusiasms that Jim has permitted himself over the years, and you know, apparently they're all still slowly percolating along in development. But you know, the scary thing to me about the November announcements was just the sheer quantity of stuff. So many shiny, pretty things to be distracted with, and it was hard enough to get one camera out the door. And they were ultimately very successful with it. But now they have such a diverse range of cool toys they want to build. It seems like a lot of opportunity for distraction and you know, creating new specifications and new combinations and new spinning rendered turntables.
Well, we should just step back for a moment for people that may not have heard some of these latest round of announcements about December 3. It's a very small, very short little blip on Red User. Basically just saying, new announcements on December 3rd, everything has changed just as we promised. We had several nice breakthroughs today that will translate into Scarlet and Epic details shortly. As we stated, drastic changes, expect it and you won't be disappointed.
See, now what I think, I honestly think it's a framing problem. And this is my prediction based on nothing, no insider knowledge, just to be clear on this. I think what's going to happen is that they're going to say, we have much better specs on either the dynamic range or the frame rate. The idea of what happened at November 13 was a packaging modularity concept. It was like, let's change the modularity of how these things go together. They weren't really pushing the chips except for the ginormous, ridiculous thing. They weren't really sort of pushing changes in the chips so much because we'd already heard about, you know, Mysterium X and the Monstro and stuff. Monstro. So you were saying, well, this is a much better way of doing the actual form build on it. And I think if they do what I think they're going to do, they're going to announce that they've got vast improvements in either what they're getting in terms of data rates or the dynamic range, hopefully, or, you know, something in that area, which actually feeds into that. Because I can't imagine that they've got a better way of doing the actual bodies. So I think it's going to come down to...
I think people are maybe reading a bit too much into this. It's either going to be three things. Like, it'll be specs, it'll be delivery times, or it'll be price, I guess. And I think one or more than one of those will improve. So...
The only thing that then throws
a spanner in that is the comment that says that November 13 announcements are insignificant.
Yeah, that's the one. And maybe to a certain extent you could argue that just the packaging of the cameras is less important than the quality of the pictures. So, Stu, tell me, you actually had a phone call from Jim in light of, I believe, a blog comment that you made about how there wasn't quite the right combination of things in the 13th announcement. And as we only have the 13th announcement to go on, could you explain to us what you didn't see that you thought you wanted in the November 13 announcement?
Yeah, absolutely. So I wrote a post on ProLost called "Too Much Is Not Enough," and I gave myself some time to digest the announcement, and the more that I looked at the Pick Your Brain page of the brochure, the more I realized that, for me, the sweet spot was not represented there. Whereas I think you had mentioned before in your conversation with Ted, right, that Red had kind of, to some degree, established themselves as a 4K oriented company, you know, and here we are with a page full of camera bodies, not a one of which has 4K, but some that have a little less and some that have quite a bit more spatial resolution, and that spatial resolution is a predominant fixation with Red and I think with some of Red's fans, and yet it is not really ultimately one that I share, but it's a natural outcropping, or so it seemed, of the desire to kind of slam together the world of digital stills and motion. So, you know, what appeared to me to be the case was that the influence of the need for a higher resolution to be competitive in the stills market meant that the right sweet spot for filmmakers was being kind of missed. And to me, that sweet spot is a Super 35 sensor that's between 3 and 4K Beyer origination. And it may well be that is just something that they can't build cost effectively, but I wondered why the chip had to, at the same size, become 5K instead of, you know, maybe staying 4K and gaining something else in terms, like maybe, you know, higher frame rates or better dynamic range or something else. I mean, one can only speculate about this if you're not in the business of making chips. But to me, at least, it felt like the body that I kind of thought I wanted was the Super 35 sensor. But that was, you know, to achieve any kind of overcranking, you were going to be spending a lot more on that than one used to spend for just a Red One body. And that Red One body, of course, included things like ports and an LCD display.
Is it fair, do you think, to level criticism that what they're experiencing is what the stills guys have shown, which is it's easier to increase megapixels than it is to increase dynamic range?
Well, sure. And the funny thing is that was in stills, you know, there's an active discussion about whether that, you know, whether that technology arms race has a soft ceiling or not. But for motion picture work, it absolutely has a ceiling. There's only so much resolution at origination that really can ultimately translate into a better experience in the theater. And there will always be special case uses for larger formats and higher resolutions, and specifically those of us in the visual effects world could oftentimes find great use for, you know, incredibly more detailed captures of images to do fancy things with in post. But for just a filmmaker going out there, you know, between 3 and 4K is kind of a sweet spot. But Red has gotten us all accustomed to, you know, the cinema-sized sensor and the lenses that correspond to that. The idea that we would maybe have a cinema-sized sensor that we'd be able to use DSLR lenses, powered DSLR lenses on, and that it would be somewhere even in the realm of the ballpark of the price of the DSLRs that Jim himself said that he was going to, attack. kill. it sort of seemed like maybe somewhere in that lineup ought to be something kind of affordable with a kind of big chip that had a reasonable range of frame rates and a resolution that was appropriate for filmmaking.
So let me let's discuss a couple of those points, because I think you make some really excellent points there. I think the first thing that I want to touch on is that I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, the need to go to 9K, the only valid, in fact, honestly, the only person that's ever made a valid reason for wanting to go to what we might call the equivalent of a mid-format stills thing is you, Jason, who said you wanted it because you wanted
the
depth of
I
field.
I don't care
of,
if it's 9K.
Yeah.
If they have to make it 9K to make a chip that size, then fine. That's par for the course. And even for that money, even
but you were
accessorized
saying
up,
you would do that for commercials. So, yeah. Ironically, you would want this 9K camera to produce what is effectively standard def images, because you just, after the depth of field properties of it or HD, but you know.
Or a feature, yeah.
Yeah, but not.
But essentially getting down to 2K, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's more about the size of the image and getting almost approaching, you know, VistaVision size and above, near 70 mil imagery.
Okay, so because I mean, I just do not see cinema chains investing heavily in 4K projection. I mean, not for a while, because 2K is kind of so adequate. I don't see, even myself, that, you know, Red's going to sort of completely revolutionize the market in a fast enough time frame to even go to 4K projection, even if they came out with which I'm sure they're still working on the Red Rain stuff. So really, you know, that $45,000 camera for me wasn't a big thing. The thing for me was that I liked the idea of using PL mounts, which I want to discuss mounts with both of you in a second. And I like the idea of being able to use, you know, Canon or Nikon lenses on it. And so the only other provider or, you know, thing that influenced me heavily was dynamic range. And so by being able to go to a Monstro and have the higher latitude, I don't know if it'll, you know, in the field be the 13 stops that they're predicting, but, you know, definitely higher than they're getting now. I could see that being a huge benefit. Having PL mount seemed like a really great thing for me because, quite frankly, I don't want to have to buy a ton of lenses with different mounts. Well, maybe we should discuss mounts. Let's swing to mounts, because I think mounts actually is one of the areas that hasn't been given enough attention in the general discussion, because, as you say, Stu, there's kind of an obsession with the frame size. And I think other people are discussing dynamic range, but the lenses you can put on it are a huge factor.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for me, again, part of, you know, these announcements from Red came on the heels of the two kind of flagship video DSLRs, right? So a lot of us assumed, rightly or wrongly, that at least part of what caused the rethink about Scarlett and Epic was due to this sudden appearance of extremely affordable, large sensor motion cameras that were kind of broken and fledgling and an accidental byproduct of technology development in a completely separate field, and yet managed to occasionally produce fairly compelling moving pictures. So you know, we go into this with at least some expectation that the current state of DSLR, the DSLR world, is going to be reflected or influential in these new designs. And I, for one, was certainly hoping that, you know, my Canon lens habit might directly translate into my experience with whatever Red might offer. That the idea of only having to collect one type of lenses is certainly appealing to me on a personal level.
I mean, if you go back to October, the thing that excited me the most was the thought that Scarlett would turn from, you know, this $3,000 camera for 3K with a fixed lens into a $3,000 camera at 3K with a Canon lens. That was it. That's all they had to do to me, right? I mean, I love going to a high frame rate. If it was $3,000 and I could put Canon lenses on it, that would have been enough, right? Right there.
Yeah.
Which is there. That camera is there. Yeah.
Because on the info that came out at the time,
I'm sure they said that.
There must be a revision, because the info that came out at the time was that it was only a B4 mount or a C mount or the mini Red mount, not a Canon or Nikon mount.
I'll have to.
You had to go to the $7,000 Scarlett to get the Canon or Nikon mount. That was the initial.
Keep up.
Okay, so...
I don't know. I could be devastatingly wrong. I had a feeling.
Well, of course, we're all devastatingly wrong, because all of them are going to change. But yeah, that's what I'm seeing here, too. And that's when I started to kind of weigh these things. Like, okay, well, I don't actually poo-poo on the two-thirds-inch format the way some do. But if I were to get the 3K body without the, without the fixed lens, then suddenly I'm now shopping for a whole new class of, you know, lenses for that size, and that was a place that I was hoping to not be. I was also hoping to not have to do that deal with the devil of trading off sensor size for frame rate, when in fact I'd happily trade resolution for frame rate.
Yeah, well, that's why I liked the idea of the Scarlett with the Nikon or Canon mounts, because it was 120 frames a second, which, you know, once you get to 100 frames a second, that's a good slow-mo. And it was 3K, or at least actually it was 2.5K without any lenses. And a bit better. In the original Scarlett, they'd hoped to hit 100 as opposed to 36 or 20, whatever it is, 28 on the current Red in terms of the backplane data rate. So this was now Red Code 42. Okay. So let's discuss these mounts for a second, because I think some of the discussion that I've certainly seen around the net is just like, oh, well, that's just going to come. Like, it's just like, it's an obvious choice. That'll happen. And I think that we owe it to just get slightly more geeky, certainly on this program, and just actually discuss what some of these mounts are all about, because I don't think maybe everybody fully appreciates just how tough it is. Like, a mount seems to be almost like you know, how can I put this, the hinges on a door. Yeah, like I put any hinges on you like,
yeah,
right? Whatever
right.
bloody hinge, I don't give a. It's not about the hinges, mate. It's about the friggin' door.
Yeah, put any door you like on there.
Yeah, but it isn't actually that simple. And so let me get geeky here for a second and feel free, guys, to stop me. But just for a brief minute, the fact of the matter is that I don't have a problem with 2/3-inch sensors either. They are incredibly successful on things like the F-35. Oh, sorry, the F-23. Because the F-23, hence the 2.3, is a 2/3-inch sensor, and it produces a higher dynamic range than the Red does, and it produces great pictures. So I don't have any problem with that sucker whatsoever. Now, it does cost 100 and something, maybe 150,000, so I have, you know, would like it a little cheaper.
And then some.
Yep. But there's nothing. So let's not focus on the sensor for a second, but let's focus on the mount. That camera, the F-23, has a B4 mount, and B4 mounts are inherently a good mount. They're solid, they're professional, but they incorporate in the actual mount, by definition, a back focus adjustment to adjust where the image gets placed onto the sensor. Now, you might think this is a bit odd, not you guys, but obviously I'm someone listening. Why do I need to be so fussy about how I focus the image to the sensor? Should I just be worried about the focus in the lens of the subject matter? But let me express it this way. The adjustment level that you need to get it nailed so that your image accurately sits on the sensor and not sort of focuses effectively a smidge in front of it or a smidge behind. If you took a, in my country, a $5 bill, I think, do you have a $5 bill in America? No.
Yes, we used to, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But
it's
like
become a point now.
Okay, so just a normal kind of note of that kind of denomination.
They're rare.
If you were to divide that note in terms of its width, the actual thickness of the node, into hundredths, right? So you have a hundredth of the thickness of a note, not a cross, is the kind of tolerance you need for where you need to land that sucker on the plane. So when we're talking about adjusting back focus, it isn't some kind of crude adjustment that'll, like a projector on a screen where you're in and out of focus a bit and that'll do. We're talking about highly accurate focusing on the image plane. So a B4 mount has that built into the actual mount. Now, PL mount, like a 35mm PL mount, such as you see on the Red, doesn't have that. You're meant to either use shims or, in the case of Red, the adjustable PL mount to accurately land that sucker on the image plane. But this is something that we need to sort of understand. The fact that it's smaller, 2/3-inch, means it's about 6 times more difficult to get that image right than it is on a 35. So the 35 doesn't have that built into the lens. It's not part of the mount. But on B4, it is totally there because it is so critical and so much harder than it is on the much larger PL mount, or for that matter, Panavision mount, the PV mount. So when we're talking about it being a B4 mount on that 3K Scarlett 2/3-inch sensor, that's not a trivial point. Like just saying, oh, I'm going to whack a Canon or a Nikon on there. How would you adjust the Canon or Nikon? And, you know, you're suddenly getting a whole new range, which is why the fixed lens Scarlett makes so much sense, because they can be very, very accurate in their tolerances when building the darn thing. Or just shimmy it at the factory as it's being put together so it aims correctly. Now, once you go to the 5K Scarlett, the $7,000 one, you've now moved up to a PL mount or a Red mount, which presumably is the Red mount, like a PL mount, probably doesn't have a back focus adjustment built in. But that's when the Canon and Nikon's coming out. Now, Canon and Nikon don't have back focus adjustments. No stills photographer gets obsessed with back focus.
That's right.
Because the sensors are big enough that, again, you don't have these insane tolerances that you do down at the 2/3-inch. So, Stu, I want to ask you a couple of questions about it. And I know you don't work for Canon, but you obviously know a lot about stills. So if I was to talk about a stills camera as a video camera for a second, let me ask you this. Like, how big a sensor is a 5D got in comparison to these Super 35 or 2/3-inch sensors?
Well, I guess it's most similar to the FF35 category of the Red announcements. It's Super 35 is half of the size of a 5D sensor. So the film equivalence would be that, you know, Super 35 is the full width of the 35mm neg, and it's 4 perfs tall, and the film runs vertically through the gate. If you tip that on its side and use 2 frames instead of 1, Then in the language of film, that's called VistaVision. And North by Northwest was shot in it, as were most of the visual effects elements for, you know, Star Wars, for example. And that VistaVision size is what we think of when we think of a full-frame SLR. When you're shooting 35mm film in an SLR, you're shooting 8 perfs, and the film is traveling horizontally through the gate. And that is, in stills world, that is what is considered full-frame. And that was the revolution of the 5D, was that it was the first full-frame digital SLR that was even remotely affordable.
So by that logic, then, it's relatively easy, I do say relatively, to get it accurately doing back focus, because the sensor's big enough that we're not down in the, you know, incredibly hard area for getting proper back focus. Which brings me back to the B4 for a second, because the other thing about the B4 versus, say, a PL mount is just the depth from the front of the sensor to the back of your lens, the bit you want to put your finger on. And on a PL mount, I believe it's like 52mm plus or minus 2/1000th of a millimeter. On a PV mount, which is the Panavision one, it's like about 60, is it? It's about 60. So you can put a PV mount onto a PL camera with adjusters, but you can't put a PL on a PV camera. Now, a B4 has only 48mm from the back of the glass to the sensor. You might be thinking, well, what bloody difference does that make? But if you think about it for a second, if you've built something that has the actual optics, assuming that it's 48mm apart, and we've just said you have to get this accurate to, you know, 2/100ths of the depth of a banknote, then you can't just say, oh, well, I'll just whack another one on there and it'll be fine because, you know, what do I need, just a razor or something? Like, it's really like a serious, you know, deal.
Yeah, this is not something you do out in the field.
Now, they are going to have... Sorry, go on.
One way that makes it helpful to understand that is just to look at, you know, sort of what the tolerances and the types of images that you're likely to try to create. On a 5D and 35mm SLR, a 50 is considered a quote-unquote normal lens, whereas on a Super 35, that same angle of view, you would need a 35mm lens to achieve it. I don't have it handy what that same equivalent lens size is at 2/3 inch, but it's obviously a much shorter focal length. So in order to achieve just sort of a normal image, you're talking about a distance from the center of the lens to the chip that's going to be quite a bit reduced. So all the tolerances become much finer because the whole thing is miniaturized, basically.
Yeah, and so my point of obsessing about these mounts is not to just, you know, go completely bore you guys to tears with numbers, but it's just to say that when you're looking at the camera bodies and the mounts are going to be a really pivotal factor, not least of which is because, in my case, we have some PL mount lenses and I want to keep them because there's nothing wrong with them, right? The optics is not, they're terrific. So even going to a red mount for me is a bit of an ask, and that's assuming that I'm at the high end. And the low end, if I want to go to the Scarlett with the interchangeable lenses, I'm on the mini red mount, which I think the mini red mount will have to have a back focus adjustment. So right away, once you start getting to back focus adjustments and B4 mounts and stuff, this isn't your soccer mum camera.
Can I ask you a question about that, Mike? Because this is an area, this back focus adjustment thing is not something that I am an expert on. And one of the reasons that I thought that SLRs didn't have this problem was that since they're using an autofocus system that is adaptive, they don't, you know, it doesn't matter if my SLR changes focus slightly as I zoom from 24mm to 105mm on my kit lens on the 5D, because as soon as I half press the shutter release, I'm going to refocus anyway, and that focusing is adaptive to whatever is currently happening with the lens. Same thing true with live view contrast detect autofocus that is in every, you know, because these same issues would seem to then plague, you know, something like my Panasonic LX3 point and shoot camera, or certainly a point and shoot camera with a smaller chip than that. But they're using contrast detect, so they're able to kind of adapt that rinky-dink mechanism that they call a lens in those little point-and-shoot cameras, they're able to kind of squirm it around until the image is sharp, whether that's, you know, front focus or back focus or middle focus. They're able to just sort of, you know, I mean, once I dropped my LX2 on a cement floor, I picked it up and turned it on, and it ran through some sort of little calibration thing where it squeezed the lens in and out a few times, and then finally it said, yeah, I think I'm okay. You know, it seemed to have the ability to shake off any kind of mechanical, you know, mess up that I might inflict on it by throwing off its tolerances, you know.
Yeah, there are three things at play there. Firstly, absolutely right. It's the autofocusing, and it's not a measuring device. It's not like at the front it says, oh, that's 20 feet away with a little marker, and then you run a tape measure and go, hang on, that's 21 feet. That's not right.
Yeah,
it's through the lens autofocusing.
Yeah, right? Second thing is, of course, being that it's, in the case of the 5D, which is something I have, it's a friggin' great sensor, like, and I mean in size. Like, if we thought that the difference between the PL mount and the B4 was six times, then obviously it goes again up to the Super 35 format. So it's like, its tolerance is like of an order of magnitude easier for the optics to deal with, just because the sensor is so big. And the way to think of this, if you want to think of it, is just, I mean, it's a bit like a dartboard, right? If you want to hit a particular part of a dartboard, if you've got a bloody great huge dartboard, it's just easier to hit it, right?
You're the analogy king today. It's fantastic.
That's good. Fantastic. I like that.
And if it's a tiny dartboard, you've got to be really pretty good to get it, right? And so it's not that the cheaper cameras are easier and cheaper. They're actually harder. And then, of course, the third thing is nearly all those point-and-shoots are fixed lens, so you don't have the problem in a sense, because you can kind of calibrate them when you make them and have fine tolerances in manufacturing, and it's all automated and it's, you know, mass produced, and you're pretty good to start with. So it becomes an issue when you're absolutely right, when you're no longer having electronic focus, which is again what's happening, I believe, with the Scarlett 2/3 inch, and it's also happening when you take away the desire to say, well, if it says it's in focus, that'll do me.
Yeah,
I raise this to Ted. I mean, you know, the huge technology we've not seen from Red yet is auto-focusing, auto-exposure technology. And that technology is the backbone of Canon and Nikon.
Absolutely. And you know, I mean, it is, they live and die by that. Canon had some auto-focusing problems with their latest, you know, flagship SLR, and it seriously hurt them.
So we know that the Red mount and the later Epic-type cameras will have an electronic form of lens. We don't know what it is. We don't know the details of it. But certainly down at the Scarlett end, that's not the case. We don't expect, for example, that a Scarlett's going to have an electronic control of the lens. Now, it's possible. I don't know.
Fixed lens, of course.
Oh, fixed lenses, yeah.
Well, I would presume the fixed lens Scarlett will no doubt have, I'm sure, should have an autofocus method.
Yeah, well, I think has actually been confirmed, has it?
No.
Yeah, water's been confirmed because it's all been, no, but it's all been changed. I totally agree with you. I think that, so that's all, I guess, part of the thing that's kind of really significant. But also just let's think about it for a second in terms of buying lenses, right? Like you touched on it, Stu, you just want to use the lenses you have. In my case, I want to use the PLs I have. But the idea of going and buying a whole set of mini Red mounts or a whole set of new Red mounts, that's a pretty serious capital investment, because the glass is really expensive. But there's a ton of good glass out there, you know. And
there is, but it also, you know, I wrote this Prolos post not long ago called Pictures and Clarity, trying to kind of air out some of the issues that start to occur in that little crevice between the fixed lens Scarlett and the 3K removable lens Scarlett, that you know, yeah, the extra expense of those lenses, then you're manually focusing them, which means that you're going to want to opt for a higher resolution viewfinder or LCD display. And then, you know, all of the attendant considerations that come along with that, it's not a no-brainer to just sort of say, well, the fixed lens won't do it for me. I want to have a choice of lenses. Like you say, now changing focal lengths is a couple of minutes versus a couple of, you know, tenths of a second. It's a big deal. It's a big choice to make as a filmmaker what type of experience you want to have with your camera in that way.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. If you were, again, just hypothetically, wanting to build the perfect 5D, what is it between the 5D now no longer as a stills camera, but as a device for, say, effectively DV Rebel filmmaking. What is it between the 5D that we know about now that is, you know, on verge of shipping? What would it take to turn that camera into a camera that you would say, well, I wouldn't need a Scarlett because I'll just use a Canon 5D Mark, whatever?
Well, to me, it's three things that one, well, it's two things that one would hope they could actually address in firmware updates to the camera, and then two that they probably won't be, that would require, you know, further development and understanding on Canon's part of this world. The biggest one for me, obviously, is frame rate. They did 30 frames. It seemed like the logical choice, I'm sure, given that it's a camera made in Japan, predominantly for a U.S. market. So 30 is awfully close to NTSC frame rate, but I would love to have, you know, 24 frames per second, as well as any and all of the choices in between 1 and 30 frames per second. That's a deal breaker for me, but almost more than that is just the issue of manual control. Right now, trying to, you know, how you set your exposure with the 5D Mark II is a very much a wave the rubber chicken in the air and cross your fingers kind of an enterprise, and it's further infuriating because every time you capture a movie with it, the whole thing resets. So you can't even hold on to exposure settings from one take to the next, which means that as soon as you've got that little camera on a jib or a tripod or whatever, you're going to be wrenching it off to go point it at a light source, trying to get it to stop down or gain up or vice versa. So, you know, the main thing for me would be choice of frame rate and to let the movie mode enjoy the same type of control the photographers are already accustomed to exercising with their SLRs. And then the last of the three is another experiential thing, which is just how do you focus? You know, the 5D is not the type of camera that has a little flippy, you know, LCD panel that can move around and aim in a lot of different directions. It's definitely, you know, there'd be some benefit to having a separate display, but there's right now a need to have a separate monitoring solution just so that you can do reliable focus. They have substantially increased the resolution of that little LCD display on the back over the first generation 5D, but I'm still not sure that it's good enough for focusing at 1080p. It may be almost good enough, but what would be great would be sort of a edge detect focus assist tool like what we see in the Sony EX1 and EX3 has this great system where it puts a little colored outline around things that it thinks are sharp. Very helpful and not distracting at all for focusing. The last thing, of course, is that, you know, that the choice of codec is not really a good one in terms of compression rate. The types of artifacts that we associate with the H.264 codec, the banding and quantization problems, and compatibility with editing solutions. So, you know, one would hope that future codec decisions would be made with a bit more of an eye toward dropping it into some sort of editing software instead of what's best for uploading to YouTube.
So really, with firmware fixes on the 5D Mark II, the StuCam's not really there yet, is it?
No, and in fact, I think what's the company that is far more likely to get out of their own way and do this stuff right is Panasonic. They have shown a prototype of their little, what's now the G1, their Micro Four Thirds format. It's not really an SLR, but it's sort of like a miniature SLR. It doesn't have a mirror, so it can't be called an SLR. But it shoots to the Micro Four Thirds format, and it conspicuously lacks a video mode. Panasonic explained that by showing a prototype for a model they intend to release next year that would be specifically aimed at HD video. It had the AVC HD logo on the back, which is a perfectly acceptable HD format. You know, it's a 12 megapixel stills camera that shoots 1920 by 1080, one would presume, movies at a choice of frame rates, again, one would presume, and takes removable lenses that won't prohibit you from doing autofocus, even, again, one would hope, while you're shooting video. So you know, that and the
sense
G1,
that it's not that far away from Super 35.
No, it's not that far away, and the G1 is $800 with a lens right now, US. You know, so that's kind of that's what next year is looking like. At the very least, we know that camera's coming. If it's $1,000 with a lens and it shoots 1920 by 1080 HD movies with the full suite of consumer-friendly automatic features as well as manual control and a post-friendly codec for $1,000, that's kind of thrilling, and that's the landscape that Red is entering into with these you know, offerings that that owe as much to their legacy as to their vision for the future.
But when you look at, I suppose when you look at all of those and what's probably going to be coming, D800s or D700Xs or D3Xs that are going to be from Nikon, they're going to be able to do maybe what the D5 Mark II is doing now and beyond. They're still essentially a fantastic stills camera that can do video. And essentially what Red's doing is the flip side of that, is fantastic film cameras that can do stills. I don't think necessarily we're quite killing the DSLR side of things, but it seems like the Canons and the Nikons are 100% doing the stills market with just, you know, 50% edging into. They're not the super ideal video cameras, really.
I mean, in my bag, I have my 5D always with me, right? And if something happened, I unzip it, I pull it out, flick the on switch, and given that I might want to tweak something minor, I can just take shots almost straight away, right? Like, I mean, that is a DSLR for me. It is completely. Now, I want to swap lenses if I'm doing real work, but I'm, you know.
And then if you're traveling, you can go to whatever. You can go to a SIGGRAPH or whatever and put that on a tripod and shoot interviews.
My question, though, yeah, exactly.
Well, you can, you know.
No, totally. I mean, but I guess.
At 35 mil depth.
Yeah, totally. So has anyone got excited about the stills prospect of these cameras, or is it just that they also do stills things?
Well, in New York Times Sunday Magazine just recently, there was a series of stills that were shot with a Red One. Did you guys see that?
No.
It was a really interesting shoot. The photographer whose name I'm forgetting, of course.
That was the expressions of people playing video games?
Yeah, young children playing video games, and he rigged it up so that they were staring straight into the lens and looking at a reflection on a piece of glass of the screen of the video game console they were playing. And they were playing things like Grand Theft Auto and violent adult video games. And they're staring right into your eyes, basically, and they have these incredibly vacant looks on their faces. And what he did is he just ran the Red One at speed and then combed through the footage and picked the frames. So the very thing that every stills photographer is dreading, this guy is embracing. And so hitting that question straight on the nose of whether a camera that is just, it's the ultimate, what in the world of stills is called spray and pray, right?
Yeah.
Which is tempting to do when you get your hands on a high-end DSLR. You just hold down the button and you probably are going to get one shot there where the entire wedding party is not blinking, it's quite the opposite of the sort of, what a lot of stills photographers find to be their artistic pursuit and unique skill is capturing that moment of knowing exactly when to release the shutter. They frown on spray and pray. Well, the Red proposition is the ultimate incarnation of spray and pray, right? You 120 frames per second, there's got to be something good in there. And you could actually even potentially have started recording a second before you push the button, because the thing might just be always going.
I think there's certainly going to be a reasonable section of stills market that's going to be very happy with the higher end of epics and things. The more and more, if you go onto a really big stills shoot, it looks like a film shoot. They have a massive video village with 10 people looking at monitors, choosing frames. And I think, the future is an even bigger video village with the guy shooting on a Scarlett or a 645. And rather than going, that's not quite right, we'll try it again, turn and I'll shoot. You're doing 25 frames of spray and pray, and they're choosing, rather than choosing them out of a Lightroom, choosing their good frames out of Lightroom, they're choosing it by timecode.
Let me shift our conversation back now to that phone call you had with Jim, because now we've established for everybody concerned what the issues are and certainly what our private thinkings were. You posted and then you got this phone call. Did your opinion change at all after talking to him?
Well, you know, no, but, you know, it's a common refrain that Red listens, you know, and I was very gratified to get the email from Jim offering to give me a call, but it was not a call where he was offering to hear my opinion. It was a call where he was offering to explain things better and help me understand what it was that maybe I was missing about the lineup. And in truth, he did clarify and offer me some insight into what aspects of this line of camera bodies are maybe not so marketing language friendly. So I posted a follow-up thing about that, about how basically even the S35, Scarlett and Epic, the size of the chip is slightly bigger than Red One, slightly bigger than traditional Super 35, which had a lot of people scratching their heads saying, well, how am I going to use that? Well, the answer is that you don't necessarily have to. You could happily window into the sensor and use only as much of it as you had been with your Red One. It becomes the 5K sensor at that point becomes a 4K sensor at that window, and you're using it just as you had been your Red One, but you've got this elbow room should you ever want to try a different set of lenses or try a different experiment. One of the things that you get with, for instance, the FF35 sized sensor is, which is 6K, is the ability to pull a 4K window out the middle of it, and it's literally 4,000 by 3,000 pixels by my estimation, that would be Academy size. And that would mean that you could aim anamorphic lenses at it and capture the full record of the anamorphic lens as opposed to the sort of cropped version that we have right now with the Red One with its 16x9 sensor. So he was proposing a system whereby the sensor size is not really a format, but in fact encompasses as many formats as you ever might want to use within it, and that those formats reflected that trade-off between resolution and frame rate that I was hoping for. The reason that I don't quite fully buy it is that at any of them, even at the FF35 Mysterium Monstro size chip, a 3K window is not Super 35 size. So there still isn't what I wanted. There still isn't a 3K window that goes, you know, all the frame rates that I would like. But there's a 4K window that goes all the frame rates that are almost all the frame rates that I would want. The problem is it's, $35,000. So the result of the conversation was, sure, in fact, I was wrong. Jim is building exactly the camera I wanted, and he's charging me, you know, twice the cost of a Red One body for it.
Yeah, but I guess from my point of view, at the professional end of the market, not necessarily at the independent filmmaker end of the market, I didn't have a problem with that. I mean, I really like, I like some combination of the S35 or FF35. You know, I want it to have PL mount, but I want it to have the Monstro chip. I want it to have, you know, Nikon and Canon mount options.
I totally agree. And there's nothing wrong with these prices for the professional market. Absolutely not. I think maybe, you know, the perception issue that Red struggles against is, you know, they're a victim of their own success in that way. But but they went into it with the Red One building the best, smallest, most affordable camera that they could that hit what they designed to be a specific sweet spot of what filmmakers wanted. And really what they wanted as filmmakers, what Jim wanted as a filmmaker. And so we wound up with Super 35, 4K, which, you know, as I think has been amply discussed, is not really about 4K per se, but is about creating a really, really solid, you know, somewhere in the realm of 2K or a little bit more image for ultimate projection. Or go full 4K if you want. I mean, it's a perfectly legitimate way to go. It was a sweet spot for filmmaking, and they brought it in at a record affordable price, and they made it as compact and as useful a package as they could. They aimed for something specific, and they got as close to it as they could, and they got much closer than anyone had ever dreamed anyone would get at that price range. It seemed like a real David move as opposed to a Goliath move, you know? And it's funny how, having given that, how offering something like the FF35, Epic for $35,000 suddenly feels like a Goliath move, when in fact it totally isn't. You know, it's totally still a David move, you know?
I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, like, let's face it, as we said before, the F23, which has a 2/3-inch sensor, which is you can only find at the Scarlett line, with a B4 mount, which you can only find in their $2,500 camera, is, to some degree, the same as the, these two cameras, and between the Sony F23 and the Scarlett 2/3, and that literally is the difference between $2,500 and maybe $150,000. Yeah. And now, of course, the $150,000 one has an SR deck in it. But
you want to record on something? sorry, that's another $75,000.
The cheapest 2/3-inch HD video camera that I could find when I was trying to figure all this stuff out is $14,000 US.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, you know, you can't begin to, you know, I mean, the difference between $2,500 and $14,500 is certainly the difference between me being able to buy one or not. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's just totally. But having said that, yeah, like, it's, you're right, there's this kind of perception. I think that is actually a problem. I would have said it wasn't Red's fault, but I've kind of moved my opinion now. It is a bit Red's fault because they do wind up the hype knob quite a lot. But they are sort of like, we are going to produce the ball terror. If you don't find this impressive, then I resign and leave the industry, because this is the most earth-shattering thing in the history of man. And and the trouble is that people literally are kind of now expecting to get a DV cam at 4K for the price of a DV cam. And and I guess it's partly funded by the just Moore's law of the computer industry, that, you know, things do seem to jump in leaps and bounds. But there's no doubt about it. Like, if they did something at only a factor of a quarter of the cost, people would be like, oh, really?
It's only a quarter of the cost? People's expectations have definitely been, you know, severely altered. I mean, if you bother to, I still think if we look at a lot of these things, they are totally astounding.
Totally astounding. Now
they are, but they're coming on the heels of these weird, you know, the Nikon D90 and the Canon 5D Mark II, which don't fully meet the needs of people, shooting movies. But as I blogged recently, you know, filmmakers don't seem to care. You know, they're bringing art to the technology fight, and they're going out and shooting with these things. And damn it, if they're not producing really sexy images with them. And, you know,
I totally agree with you. Though, by the same token, who hasn't been on a professional shoot where people have been saying, well, the trouble with the Red is that it just, this clip here isn't quite in the right position, and you know, like, this clip here is like, and the trouble is that, you know, if you think about it in terms of these nuts, they should all be the same size and none of the things, and you're like, wow, that's really picky. So really picky versus independent filmmaker who says, you've provided me with an enabling technology, and I will actually even design the script, write the script around dealing with some of these compromises. And quite frankly, I think sometimes scripts are better when they have a couple of obstacles to get around, because the restrictions actually improve the filmmaking, not necessarily pull back from it.
Well, that's right. Stu and I were talking about this the other day, that I think it's only a matter of time, 6 months or something, before something Born Identity 11 or whatever is being shot on something 5D Mark III or something. You're going to see these very small, very compact 35mm depth cameras, which are just in there for run and gun shooting, where you've got five units in there for 5 days versus a big film crew with one unit for 1 day, and you're going to get twice as much footage to work with and be twice as mobile. And the smaller sort of stuff is really going to change the industry, I think. I think we're going to.
Well, the last point I want to finish up with is following on from that, Jace, because if you and I know anything, it's there was a pretty significant hurdle getting people to cope with one type of R3D file. And now we're talking about trying to get an industry. And let's face it, they dropped, what, three and a half thousand cameras in the market in 12 months, right? Which was a great thing, but it totally overran Post's ability to know how to do anything with it, and the equipment suppliers to even be able to deal with them, and the, you know, the bills were changing, and So now, if you drop, say, for argument's sake, five times as many cameras at this price range in the market with this many different codecs, this many different sizing, I mean, I can't...
Literally, whatever you want, customizable crop out of that sensor, whatever you want it to be.
I mean, you know, just...
A world of hurt?
Well, it's really going to be pretty, actually, restricting.
It's a huge problem, because it's not just that a whole show might be some weird resolution. It's that a whole show's overcranked material might be some weird resolution that's totally different than the rest of how the show was shot. So who is making these decisions about how that stuff is made editable, and who is picking then the ultimate resolution that the stuff is onlined at? It is. More than enough rope to hang yourself with, and could be very scary to go into a project trying to spec out which of these puzzle pieces you're going to try to put together and what the result is going to be.
But as more, I mean, I'm thinking for the moment, let's talk about Final Cut world. At the moment, if you think of the whole project resolution thing, and now just that. Very soon, or now, I think Final Cut Pro is going to start working with.
It's out now.
Yeah, with the native files.
Yep.
You get, theoretically, you should be able to do, you know, drag and drop footage into a timeline and all the resolution.
Let me be devil's advocate. We're 1 year in. Final Cut now, for the first time, supports native R3D. Took them a year. Doesn't support 4K. There are three options. You can transcode, which takes time. You can use RAW, but then people have trouble editing unless they're on totally specced out machines. Or third, you just go back to using the QuickTimes that we had for the last 12 months. And all of that is based off one kind of R3D coming in. And my point is, I guess, like, I haven't even got to, like, the stills guys, like Aperture and Lightroom being able to, you know, handle the RAW formats from... Because I definitely going to want to use Aperture. I guess my point is just that it took us a year to get there. And that was, we could see it coming, and that was the probably most Red savvy product, Final Cut. Don't even talk about a Flame or a...
Yeah.
By the way, Stu, loving that you got the Flames in at the orphanage, mate. Way to go.
You know, it was only a matter of time.
Yeah. But you know what I'm saying? Like, it's just unbelievable amounts of pain. And we were discussing this, right? The thing about 2 to 4K is it sounds like it's not that many. It's just 2 more K, right? It's like, how much worse can it be? It's like, well, it's four times as worse. It's what? It's like four 400%. Times. And they're like, well, how much are we talking about here? Well, instead of a dub taking an hour, it's going to take 4 hours. Well, that's not right. So, well, yeah, it is actually. Like, what? I mean, four times the data, it doesn't get faster. You know, and so somebody walks in with a 9K set of stuff.
Yeah.
Can I just get a dub of all of that?
We've got three units. I've got a Scarlett S-Sup35 doing 30 frames at 5K. I've got my main unit shooting 645 at 25 frames, which is 9K. I've got B-Cam is on the 5K Super 35 Epic.
And we had a bunch of the crew that was shooting with their Scarlets, and they were just wondering if we could just double out.
B-Cam has been shooting at 50 frames. Yeah, off you go.
Well, all of that, you know, it's interesting, this, you know, this DSMC idea and this sort of, I don't know, it seems to me that... there is really something to be said. You know, RAW is great. I'm a huge fan of RAW. We all saw, though, you know, how long it took the industry to know what to do with Panalog, which was one format, a non-moving target that didn't change over the years, and was amply documented, and that came with support files and charts and graphs and explanations and algorithms.
And quite frankly, it didn't go through multiple builds. I mean, it wasn't...
Right, exactly. Yeah. It never changed, and yet people still got thrown for a loop by it and were very perturbed and confused by it because it wasn't exactly the same as what they had always used, you know? RAW is great, but it's... When you can do anything, you can do a million wrong things, and the right things become a needle in a haystack. The thing about the the SLRs that have already solved the really hard problem of being good at stills is that I actually think there's something to be said for capturing the full gigantic resolution of what the SLR sensor can grab and then downsample it, you know, debayering it, maybe even quickly in the camera, you know, maybe even not at the highest quality levels, but you're also then downsampling it to HD resolution and recording it to a reasonable codec. I think there's a lot to be said for that. I think that could produce some really nice images. I mean, everyone's astounded by the 5D Mark II's low light performance. Part of that is that,
processing.
You know, the noise that is happening at the sensor resolution is completely mushed away by the scaling down and subsequent compression at HD resolution. And the result is that people are saying, oh, it's better in low light than the Red. Well, I'm sure that's not true, but apparently the net result is that it seems to be, and isn't that really ultimately all that matters to the people putting the images on the screen?
Well, I've done, and I'm sure everyone's done plenty of Red stuff where you've just gone straight from the proxies. People do it all the time. People, you know,
absolutely.
The one
in
thing
fact,
that
I'm sure way more people are doing that than are quote unquote doing it the right way. You know, that's where this RAW thing really might, at these gigantic resolutions, and if it really is, as Jim says, sort of an impossibility to build a big sensor but save money by having it be lower resolution, then I start really getting quite interested, not in windowing my 5K sensor down to 3K, but in downsampling my 5K sensor down to HD and recording something that's already debayered and still nice and, you know, low contrast with maybe a nice simplified, predictable, you know, either log or gamma curve, something that I can easily understand and drop into a pipeline that I already have working.
In-camera Red Alert.
I'm not really obsessed with the idea that it be RAW. In fact, I'd much rather, as I recently wrote on ProLust, have Red support some kind of simple best case transfer functions for their R3Ds so that the industry can at least say, well, are you using option A, B, or C, or are you rolling your own? You know, right now it's already confusing, it's already a problem, and it stands to become much, much, much more of a headache.
Well, I guess for me, I think that it's a really workable system right now. It makes perfect sense to me. But I come from it from understanding how freaking hard it is to do C-sort telecine lists, right, and to do cut and egg. So for me, it's a joy. Now, if you're coming at it from I'm used to shooting on, you know, I don't know, high 8, then I got my DV cam or HDV cam, and now this Red thing seems really, really complicated, then I would buy into that. I think if you're coming at it with a film background, Red makes a whole lot of sense, and it isn't actually that hard, and I don't mind. On professional shoots, you know what? I mean, rigging up a 35 camera like takes time, you know? Bloody hell, putting the film in a black bag and closing your eyes and changing the mag is harder than transferring R3D files. I'm quite comfortable in saying that.
But you solved the guy that problem, does it, Mike, by wrapping your arms entirely around the pipeline. I mean, you have a scratch and you control, you know, the Red footage you shoot, you transfer yourself. You've painstakingly established a best case workflow that works for you. The guy immediately next door to you has done exactly the same with all of his own personal blood, sweat, and tears, and he's come up with a different answer that works perfectly for him. Heaven forfend that the two of you should ever want to work on a project together, because now you have to argue about whose way of dealing with R3Ds is better, you know.
But what I was heading towards was that at the Red One level of only having 3,000, 4,000 cameras out there, I think that's a valid thing, right? It's a new technology.
Yeah.
The trouble is when you introduce the Scarlets and you're talking about, say, a $3,000 camera, or, you know, a $3,000 camera with a fixed lens, all blah, blah, you no longer, you've forgone the right now to start comparing it to loading film in a black bag. You now have to compare it to which is my second favorite camera in the world, is our HVX 200. I love our P2 camera. I mean, we have a ton of them. Like, we have P2 cameras. We shoot with them all the time. I love this camera. So, and that's what I need to be comparing to, not to film, by the time I hit Scarlett. And P2 took a little bit of time for people to get their head around. But once we got a Firestore on it and everything else, you know, it was good. So I think we're still not at the soccer mum level, but we're definitely, there's a level between soccer mum, which is point and shoot, and comparing it with film bags and loaders. And I think the HVX200, I've always said this, that is a sweet spot to get a Scarlett to be an HVX200 replacement. For me, is a particularly useful place for it to be.
Absolutely. They're going to sell a lot of those.
That, do you think that Lumix G could be your, exchangeable lens HVX replacement?
I mean, quite possibly.
Audio. Well, there's a lot of audio issues with a lot of that sort of stuff.
All yeah,
of
audio stuff is definitely
is so thrown away and miniaturized.
Yeah, I mean, we really
let's not
get around that HVX200. It has proper XLR connectors, yeah. Proper monitoring. It has just a whole bunch of stuff.
Now
it's fixed lens.
There's you can just grab the level.
But it's it goes full manual and it goes to automatic. It goes point and shoot a bit, but it's not so point and shoot that it's you can't mount it without it wobbling. Yeah. I mean,
a lot of this stuff is meant to, is going to be on projects like Docos where you really want to run single system sound.
And there's a ton of interview stuff in a studio or a semi-studio environment. Somebody's home, you put up three lights, put a tripod down and put an HVX on it, and you want it to work 100% reliably and be silent when it's filming and film somebody. And you know what? A 720p resolution is unbelievably good for that kind of work.
Yeah,
absolutely.
If it's well lit.
Yeah, that's all, everything you're saying is why I think Canon and Nikon are confused about why they put this video feature into these SLRs. They think that it's for photojournalists who are increasingly being called upon to provide video as a component of their image gathering, and yet I just think that's ridiculous. To take someone who has this effortless relationship with this machine designed to get out of the way and let them, like you say, whip it out of the bag and immediately start making images. And these are pros who utilize all of the pro features of the very expensive SLRs to then give them this sort of auto only kind of rinky-dink video mode at cumbersome resolutions. But with then, no niceties such as autofocus and no ability to control the audio levels or really have any kind of pro audio input. It's like the world's worst video camera for news. There's nothing spontaneous or catch the emergency as it's happening about it. And yet for a third the price of a L series, zoom lens and smaller in size, you could tuck an HV30 in your pocket and whip it out whenever you needed to shoot some video. I don't see these video SLRs as being for journalists and they're for filmmakers. They're for people who are willing to spend some time and massage an image into existence.
You're at a fire and you want to hold your digital SLR video camera up over the heads of the firemen to get the shot. I mean, you just can't even see what you're looking at, right?
But any video camera is going to have the little twisty LCD, which by the way, the Lumix G is going to have too.
Now, having said that, I think there's not just the filmmaker. Well, you say the filmmaker, and let me just say, when you say filmmaker, especially you, I think of somebody jumping over a table and somebody throwing bits of shattered plate at them and jumping in a subway and shooting, action footage. When I say that market I was talking about, it's in addition to that market, there's the market of, I want to shoot an interview with the curator of this museum discussing the latest exhibit, and it's going to be a video that plays on a screen somewhere, and it's not going on broadcast television, but it's a legitimate, what we used to call in the old days, corporate video. Yeah. And that market is completely happy to use a semi-restricted, as long as they can make it look good. You know what I mean? Like, you can make HVX200 stuff look great with good lighting.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I mean, that's the conclusion really that all of this red hype leads me to is just that, God, why am I spending so much time thinking about cameras that are going to come out a year from now? Why am I not just shooting something with this stack of cameras that I'm looking at sitting right in front of me, you know?
Well, that's because we bothered to ask you to join us today.
Yeah, I know. But I think I twittered back to Jason the other day that if I blog about Red one more time, it means that I have to go shoot a subway short with my LX3, just sort of as punishment. You know, it seems like for every bit of effort we expend, you know, scratching our heads about Jim's latest maneuvers, we should should really be trying to create something more than just
I mean, I was just we just shot a bunch of time lapse using the Red One, amazing time lapse versus shooting with Nikon and Canon 5Ds and state of the art new, what's the new Nikon top of the line thingy?
D3.
Yeah, D3. That's it. And you know what? I mean, it was really nice shooting time lapse on the Red. Like, we could really monitor it well, and we didn't have to get down on all fours and to look at the back little thing and press a button to even see if the pictures were still working or not. And so, you know, that's all interesting stuff. But I think the other thing, not to sort of be too commercial about it for a second, but we are talking about serious numbers here. Like, the amount of money that a company will make when they get this right in that area between the 5D and the Red One, when that, what I call the HVX200, I mean, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars. This is like seriously worth someone's time. This is not a plug-in for After Effects that you might make 20,000 on.
I mean, how many HVX200s have been shot? So I think we investigated that one time, didn't we? When you look at 5,000 Reds, is probably and growing. That was probably, you know, that's an excellent, you know, number of sales considering, you know, however many Genesis and F950s is like hundred, you know, in the hundreds.
Yeah, and a lot of filmmakers will be impacted
by this. When you get to this end of town, you're talking hundreds of thousands of units.
Yeah. So
absolutely, and anything that makes a 5D seem affordable is an interesting development for me. I mean, it was, you know, it's quite a while before I treated myself to a 5D. You know,
it seemed
like a luxurious, you know, it and every lens I buy for it is a luxurious little gift to myself, you know. And yet suddenly it seems downright affordable, you know.
I must admit, yeah, it's a bit like flat screen TVs. I think it literally has elevated the sense of what you'd pay for a camera. And, you know, I think it's partly to do with the fact that you're sort of spending it on yourself. Like, if you're spending this money rental, you're kind of like, but it's my own camera. It's my camera.
That's right. And I think in a way that's kind of led to some of the, I say dissatisfaction because I think a lot of it is ungrounded, but the dissatisfaction. Everyone has got two, I think, for me anyway, there's two cameras in this whole lineup for me. There's one, the ones that I'm going to get my rental companies to like queue up and get this 645, get the camera in so I can rent them. And then there's the camera that I hoped to buy for my own personal walk around. I was hoping, you know, I'd already sold all my SLRs and I just sold my movie camera.
That was stunt camera work, selling your cameras before the announcement.
So perhaps my expectations were a bit G'd up, but I think there's always been the camera for work, and then the camera for the whatever for to hold.
I want a camera I can put in my backpack, go to a NAB or whatever, do an interview with somebody, and
shoot some stills of the products for the blog.
Exactly, and it has to be able to work out of my backpack. It has to not be able to work out of a big camera box that has metal lugs.
Yeah, because you want to be able to travel, and you want to be able to, you know, not have to do carnets and things, and you just want to be able to, you know, say, it's just my stills camera, and get away with it. So the whoever cracks this, you know, the LX3 of hybrid cameras is going to definitely gonna rake it in.
But all we know right now is that that this whole conversation was in fact
pointless,
if not certainly insignificant and inconsequential.
Insignificant. That's right.
So, Stu, we do appreciate you taking the time to discuss the theory, the promise,
whenever you have something pointless and insignificant to talk about, please do let me know. I'm always there.
I know you've got nothing else useful to do.
We'll catch you on December 4 or December 3, Stu, maybe.
If you guys are listening and you have any information on the Blue Project, then please send us information, because we could be dishing a incredibly legitimate, and I want to be the guy that does that. By the same token, it could just be a really good gag. Of course, next week we'll be back with our regular kind of show with updates on stuff, and we will be discussing that Final Cut Pro update that's very significant in terms of color. Did you use color, the companion?
I pop it open and play with it every once in a while, but it drives me crazy a little bit just because of its because it is both so good and so bad. but it's I love that it exists.
I would love to get a new release of Final Cut that had a Mac'd user interface on color, because there is some technology in color, their Kia, the three-dimensional Kia stuff, that is just downright ball tearing, but it's so hidden in ugly menus for me that
the killer app, of course, would be to have all of its features just smack integrated right into the Final Cut timeline, and while I'm sure I would love it if they achieved that, while they fail to do that, I'll be happy to work on new versions of Colorista and Magic Bullet Looks to try to shore up that deficiency, because we seem to have a lot of success with allowing people to have at least some of that type of color control right there in their timeline, you know.
Yes, and for those of you that do have 2/3-inch sensors, which, you know, by the way, is about the size of your little fingernail, they are still quite good. Those little F23s still produce good pictures. So, I mean, without a doubt, we had this discussion, Stu, when we were in a dinner in San Francisco, right, that, like, this is only one part of the filmmaking equation. It's the tech geeky stuff. It's by far, you know, the case that what makes a good film is compelling story and good plot development and characters that you can care about. So we don't pretend for a second that this is everything, but it's just one part of the equation, but we do like to discuss it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an exciting time. I think next year is just going to be amazing for these cameras. It's going to be heartbreaking and frustrating at times, I'm sure, as we watch the DSLR guys try to figure out what it is that they've done, but they've certainly stirred up the pot and a lot of interesting things are bubbling up.
And certainly for you, Jason, hopefully you'll get both the camera that you can own so you can actually take some pictures again, and the camera that you can produce your Die Hard with.
Absolutely. I feel sure that I don't have to pike out and just go and buy something in the interim. I'm holding on.
All I've got. I just want to see you shoulder mount. I want to see an article in American Cinematographer, you with the shoulder mount Epic with a anamorphic lens on it, getting unbelievably good lens flares because the lens is like 25 years old before they sorted out the coatings with a big grin on your face.
Well, I might just touch on that for a second. There's a couple of renders in there of a Scarlett or an Epic on with the handheld shoulder-mounted rig. That is just outstanding. The ergonomics of it look brilliant.
Well, the ergonomics as of today look brilliant.
As of today, at time of broadcast.
the irrelevant ergonomics look pretty stunning.
No matter what they say on the 3rd of December, is anyone going to believe that they're not going to do it again before NAB? Do you know what I mean? Like, the frequency was like NAB to IBC, and then it was like November. But the break between November and December is less than a month. It's going to get down to later today at 3:00. Everything will be irrelevant. Sorry. Anyway,
they did mention that they plan to have working camera prototypes and footage at NAB, which is exciting because they tend to be pretty serious about making good on those kinds of promises. So that would be thrilling to see something.
And I will say that in defense of Red, if you were to have gone to the LA launch of these cameras, they spent maybe an hour almost showing footage of what the cameras did. Like, they know that it's about the images. I mean, we all discuss the form build factor, but I mean, when we were projecting some stuff for Red here in Australia at a professional meeting, I mean, I was really impressed with how much time and energy in a very busy schedule Ted devoted to getting the projection stuff looking good. Like, he would not let stuff be screened that wasn't properly set up, properly projected, properly done. They are not just, all about numbers and forgetting about the images. And I do think that, I honestly think that a lot of this fervor is just driven by them themselves being filmmakers and just getting all excited about it. Maybe they should learn to restrain but it's weird. Red compares to Apple a lot, you know, the reality field around Jim versus the reality field around Steve, but you couldn't have two more different management styles in terms of not saying anything until they're in
being
stores.
Being open and being closed,
And telling you what you thought of while you're in the bath this morning.
Well, I think
I agree. I think it stems directly from Jim's legitimate enthusiasm. He's a shooter. He loves images. He loves the gear like we do. But ultimately, you know, he really cares about the pictures they make. And he's, you know, you could just sense it. It was really fun to watch him unveil these irrelevant announcements that night on Red User.
That was good fun.
It was exactly the way I experience all of the Steve Jobs keynotes. I watch them online with my finger poised over the refresh button, but instead of doing that kind of in a vacuum, it was with a rowdy group of really excited people, and the way he trickled the images in, it was pretty masterful, and he did it all without having to rent out the Moscone Center. And then a week later, he makes us all feel silly about getting, you know, so preoccupied with the specifics of it. So, you know, his enthusiasms are, you know, as are so often the case, you know, they're a blessing and a curse.
Well, as my father used to say, and he was ex-British Navy, a man should have enthusiasms.
I believe that's the starting line of a very beautiful scene in The Untouchables, too, right?
So
when a man prominent, he's expected to have enthusiasms.
Exactly. So, look, again, thank you very much. And, Jace, thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
As always.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Stu.
And we'll talk to you guys next week. See you.
See you.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2008 FX Guide, LLC.